Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I want to make sure that everybody can hear. Yes, I'll speak up. It's my great pleasure today to welcome the Honourable Dr. John Bannon to speak to us this afternoon. And we're taking a break from contemporary politics to look back at Federation times, which is a great relief to all of us. And we're very honoured to have Dr. Bannon with us today. Not only is he former Premier of South Australia, but he's a demonstration that there is life after politics, because since his time in Parliament, he's become a distinguished historian, currently adjunct professor at Adelaide University Law School, and recently Master of St Mark's College. He has recently published a book on Sir John Downer, which is the subject of his lecture today. And I shall also add that he's a contributor to our Biographical Dictionary of the Australian Senate. And indeed, he wrote the biography of the first clerk of the Senate, who was another distinguished South Australian. So please welcome Dr. John Bannon.
Well, thank you very much, Rosemary, and good morning, afternoon, everybody. I'm delighted to be here to talk about history, and as the clerk has just said, it's probably a relief to delve back into the past rather than try and grapple with the amazing scenes of the present. I guess, you know, one looks for history, of course, to provide us with lessons and indicators. So to that extent, it's not exactly irrelevant to be talking history. And the history that I'm going to be talking about, I think you will discern some relevance indeed. They say it's 1940 since we last had this situation of a hung parliament in the House of Representatives. Hung parliament termed loosely, because government should be made and formed in the House and not the Senate. At that time, of course, the Senate was usually reflecting totally the government of the day. But I think if you go back a bit further and look at the period 1901 to 1910, our contemporary situation isn't hugely different from then. There were three major parties in the field. There were a raft of independent-minded people. Nobody could form a sustainable or stable majority. And the way in which those early years of Federation, where a lot of productive legislation was in fact enacted, panned out, would be quite an interesting period to look back and reflect on. It's the period, of course, where Sir John Downer was involved. So really up until 1910, we didn't have this system that we've rather got used to, and we're now having to grapple with again. The other thing I would say there too is that this was very much a federal election, wasn't it? When you think about the pattern of voting, the differences were acutely state and regional differences, a recognition in many ways of the need for a federal system in this widely diverse country with its communities with different histories, backgrounds, economic structures and so on. Yes, Australia is a nation and a great nation, but we are comprised of component parts, and the secret of federation is to provide a mechanism by which those component parts can work. And as I say, they have, each of those parts has the opportunity to say what they think should be the direction of a national government. And indeed, on the 21st of August, they showed that there was some quite strong regional approaches, state approaches to it. Well, let's go back in history, and I'll start at the convention of 1891 in March in Sydney. There are the delegates. Now, I just make the point that this is an edited version of a photo, because I just wanted to get some key people into it. There are actually some more delegates, but it's an interesting photo too. If you read the caption where you find this photo, you'll find it's bodgy. It actually names some people who aren't in the photo. It omits some who are. And it doesn't draw any attention to the fact that, for instance, Sir George Grey, the famous New Zealand governor and later Prime Minister, who was also governor of South Australia and government of the Cape, one of the eminent imperial administrators of the 19th century. He was there, certainly, but he wasn't there for the photo. A close examination suggests he and another colleague have been inserted, sort of photoshopped into it. I'm going to have this corrected in the records, because I think I'm the first person who's actually
done the detail and discovered it. However, these are the people I want you to look at. There's Sir John Downer, the subject of my paper. Clean-shaven, energetic, and just along the row from him is Edmund Barton, who is also going to be discussed in a minute. And you notice that interesting connection. Both of those men, friends and colleagues as they became, are clean-shaven. And they're the only clean-shaven delegates among these bewhiskered and bearded gentlemen. They're all gentlemen, of course. Henry Parkes, of course, a kind of Hollywood casting director's idea of a father of federation. I think he thought so anyway, though Hollywood didn't exist then, is sitting there presiding. And around him are the delegates of the various colonies in South Australia, Richard Baker and John Bray and Coburn, Thomas Playford. These names will figure. But here we have Barton, Deakin, Kingston and Downer, all of which figure in this story. Interestingly, notice Kingston stands with a resolute profile to the side. You'll find a number of photos of Kingston like that. His vanity suggested, somebody must have told him once, you look marvellous in that profile. So he tried to get himself into it wherever he was pictured. A fascinating picture of the first attempt to form a federation. These are an extraordinarily gifted and interesting group of people. Seven delegates from each of the colonies, with two from New Zealand, an Australasian federal convention. Well, I want to go to the third day of that National Australasian Convention. General speeches are being made on the principles to be embodied in a federal constitution, and Edmund Barton, New South Wales, has just spoken. He spoke at length and very eloquently on the subject. He'd asked for an adjournment in the evening because he thought delegates wouldn't be able to concentrate on his address, and rather reluctantly was granted one. So he was there for the start of the day, making a keynote address, which was closely followed. And the person who responded immediately to his speech was a delegate who'd already had an influence on the procedural debates of the convention, drawing not just on his experience as a former colonial premier and attorney general, but also as a delegate to the Imperial Conference of 1887 in London. And this was Sir John Downer of South Australia. He congratulates Barton on his speech and says it will, quote, be a very great service to us in this discussion, a speech most admirably conceived, most logical in its construction, and one which, as it is to a large extent, falls within my own views, not unnaturally carries the greatest conviction in my mind. It was, as Barton's biographer, Geoffrey Bolton, comments, the beginning of a lasting friendship. It was a friendship that saw Barton make regular journeys to Adelaide over the following decade to stay with his friend, often during the Christmas-New Year period, to get some much-needed rest and recreation in congenial and like-minded company. Barton had a tendency to overindulge and require sort of cures occasionally. For instance, in 1893-4, he was out of office. He was under a cloud of possible bankruptcy. And, you know, his career was in a lot of trouble and he was finding life very hard. He spent some weeks over that December-January period with Sir John to get himself together. And that was the sort of support that the two provided to each other. Because in 1896, Downer, who in turn visited and stayed with Barton, in 1896, after the untimely death of his wife, who'd been seriously ill during a crucial and unsuccessful election campaign, she died a week or so later, Downer sought solace with his friend in Sydney and spent some weeks there recovering. A couple of years later, as a guest of Barton in Sydney, he was introduced to a young woman friend of the Bartons, Una Stella Russell, who was present at a dinner as company for John Downer's 20-year-old son. She sat between the father and the son, but actually favoured the father. And in December 1899, she became Sir John's second wife. The marriage took place from Barton's house with Edmund as best man. So you can see the close relation these gentlemen had. Downer was elected as a delegate to the new Constitutional Convention of 1897-98. And here's another picture. This is in the courtyard of the Adelaide Parliament House. Well-known picture. This is the full delegation. Sitting in the middle is the chairman, Charles Cameron Kingston, Not quite able to get his profile in shot there. And equally, someone's played a very cruel trick on him by providing him with a special chair, which is much lower than the benches on which the others sit. Kingston was a very big man and rather proud of that too. So he sits presiding in the miniature almost next to George Reed, the figure from New South Wales, and Turner from Victoria, Forrest from Western Australia, Braddon from Tasmania, the premiers of the various states. And here on the side, rather modestly standing, hat in hand, is John Downer. Again, clean-shaven, looking not much older than he was at the time in 1891. And again, Barton, Deacon, and the various other luminaries. The absence, of course, of Sir Henry Parkes, who had died the previous year. It would have been unlikely to be a delegate anyway. So that's the 1897 convention, and this was the one over three sessions that actually drew up the constitution which we live under today. Over three strenuous sessions, Barton and Downer, with their mutual friend Richard O'Connor from New South Wales, and secretarial services provided by Robert Garran, after the delegates had retired for the day, each day of the sitting, they laboured into the night over the detailed drafting of the Constitution, the three-person drafting committee. It was a major work. With federation accomplished at the end of 1900, as Barton fretted over what course to take when Lord Hopetoun had bypassed him in favour of the anti-federal Premier of New South Wales, William Lyon, to form the first federal cabinet, Sir John was on the spot to give advice and support to his friend. He'd do so again as a member of the first Senate in support of the Barton government and its measures, remaining on intimate terms with the Prime Minister. But by late 1903, the relationship came under severe strain and fractured for many years. Sir John's disillusionment with the public course of events was matched by a personal feeling of betrayal by his closest friend and colleague. Well, before examining this, I should explain some more about Downer himself. He was born in 1843 in Adelaide, like Barton, a native-born Australian, and Deacon too. This gave them great weight, in fact, in the councils of the Federation. He was the fifth child of six, five boys and a girl, of a tailor by profession or trade, Henry Downer, and his wife Jane, who emigrated from England in 1838, just 18 months after European settlement was established in South Australia. Henry never really prospered, either at his trade or when trying his hand as an importer of groceries or as an hotelier or chancing his luck on the Victorian goldfields. But the next generation ensured he was well looked after. Four of the five brothers qualified as lawyers. George, who was 5 years older than John, became a very wealthy solicitor, financier and pastoralist, never married. John went into partnership with him soon after being admitted to the bar in 1867, effectively becoming a full-time barrister in which what was, of course, an undivided profession, and he handled the firm's court work while George did the solicitor's work. The profitable and highly successful association lasted until John's death in 1915, and George died the following year. Well, this is Downer at about the period when he'd just become a leader of the profession, a brilliant scholar, made his name quickly, and he became a QC on his own merits, not as was often the case, by means of political or Crown Law Office connection, at the age of 34. And this coincided with him taking a place in the House of Assembly. He accepted nomination for the regional seat of Barossa, not so much from a great desire to get into the power of politics, but because he felt the time had come in an established law practice for him to perform some public duty. He consistently opposed payment of members, incidentally, on the grounds that service in politics should be because people wanted to do something for a mere sense of honour and service and not for personal emolument. A rather romantic view of it, and of course one readily open to a professional who can maintain their professional income and living, a little harder for some who don't have that possibility. But it was a strongly felt view. Parliamentary service was that service, not a career. He was, in fact, to be a member of Parliament, colonial, federal and state, for all but 1 year of the rest of his life, a total of 37 years' service, undefeated in 11 elections. He quickly achieved ministerial office. He was a successful and progressive Attorney General from 1881 to 84 in the Bray government, and then Premier on two occasions, in 1885 and 87, and 1892 and 3, and a leader of the opposition for much of the 1890s. His premierships were not hugely successful, although there were some considerable achievement. On the first occasion, he was overseas attending the Imperial Conference in London when the election itself was held, a rather dangerous decision to make, but he thought it was prudent at the time. Unfortunately, the election result and vote took place as he returned on the boat from England, and the first cable he got when arriving in Fremantle was to say, sorry, your government has just fallen, the House has met, and you've been defeated, you're no longer Premier. A rather deep blow, but he got over that. He returned to office. There he is, sweeping out the sort of liberal faction of Holder and Coburn and others, supported, as it happens, by Kingston and Playford sitting over on the bench. Playford very reluctantly, because the Playford and Downer were constantly feuding with each other, a feud that, in fact, continued on through the family, right down to the generation below them, when Sir Thomas Playford, grandson of the old Thomas Playford, rather malevolently people felt ensured that a freeway was driven right through the Adelaide Hills, through the grounds of Sir Alexander Downer and his estate. And despite Sir Alexander trying to negotiate a rerouting and even pay for it, Playford was adamant. So it's funny how these things go through the generations. Of course, Downer in turn had his comeuppance. Notice, incidentally, the cartoonist always pictures Downer with a cigar. And you'll see him in pictures, caricatures, whatever, and indeed in portraits with his familiar cigar. But there he was being kicked out by Kingston forces in 1893, and he never held office again. His views were a mixture of the socially liberal. For instance, he was an early champion of women's rights. He was an opponent to a racially based White Australia policy. But he was broadly conservative in other areas, sometimes equivocal on policy issues of the day, such as free trade and protection. But there was one cause he pursued relentlessly, the Federation of Australia. When he entered the first Commonwealth Parliament as a senator, he could claim a longevity in the cause of federation unmatched by any of his colleagues in either house. He was the only member who had been present as a delegate at the initial significant federal gathering, the Australasian Intercolonial Conference, which was held in Sydney in 1883. That resulted in the establishment of the precursor of federation, the Federal Council of Australasia. And then, in 1887, the first Imperial Conference was summoned to London, delegates from all over the British Empire. And Downer, by this time Premier of his colony, was a delegate, and as one of only two Australian Premiers present, the other was Samuel Griffith from Queensland, played a very significant part in the proceedings. And there indeed he is, standing in the centre of the group. It's about April, I think, in 1887 in London. It's rainy. They've got their umbrellas, top hats, Downer. Standing next to him is Griffith, and this is Jennings, the former Premier of New South Wales, who was deputising for the then Premier, who wasn't able to attend. But these two played a significant role in the conference. Rather more modestly at the back stands Alfred Deakin, who as a very young man made a big reputation at this conference. And next to him, even more modestly, is the chairman of the committee, the colonial secretary. So it was a pretty impressive gathering from South Africa, Canada and other parts of the empire. And there they are in London. Sir John, at the time, was knighted on that occasion at the age of 42. And then in 1891, as we've seen, he was part of the Constitutional Convention in 91. In 97, he was in the convention and a member of the drafting committee. Well, with federation achieved, the period from 1901 should have been a time of great personal and a fulfillment and satisfaction for Downer. It was not to be. His protectionist credentials and personal association with Barton made him a possible ministerial cabinet, if, as expected, Barton was called on to form the first government. In the last days of 1900, Downer went to Sydney for the inauguration celebrations, staying, as was his custom, at Barton's house. He was thus a close witness and confidant during the period of the well-named Hopetoun blunder, when the newly arrived Governor-General decided to ignore advice that Barton should be asked to form a government, and instead commissioned the anti-federal Premier of New South Wales, William Lyne. Now, Lyne, delighted with this commission, he'd suddenly decided he was in favour of federation, sought the support of a number of the key players from the various colonies. Kingston of South Australia had been adamant that Barton should be chosen and declared he just wouldn't serve under Lyne. Alfred Deakin had been similarly committed to Barton, but his Premier Turner and the South Australian Premier Holder were now contemplating the possibility of joining a Lyne ministry, and Deakin began to waver. Lyne had attempted to recruit Barton as a member of his cabinet. Barton had made it clear he wasn't interested. Downer was there to support his friend in the decision and help him make clear to Deakin that he must get Turner to hold the line. Barton telegrammed Deakin on the 24th of December 1900, asserting that Lyne won't succeed, my succession inevitable unless possibly Turner changes. And Downer followed up with a succinct message to Deakin, if you are firm, your best desires certainly assured. I found a letter from Barton to Downer written in 1909, when Barton was a High Court judge and was not in a position to comment publicly. There'd been speculation at this time following the death of Holder, the then Speaker of the House of Representatives. He died actually on the floor of the House in a dramatic moment, which is recounted in some areas. A fine speaker and respected man. But it was suggested at the time that he, Holder, had been the person to break the chain and resolve the issue in Barton's favour. Now, in J. Lanoza's fine account of the Hopetoun blunder, he notes the meetings Lyne held with Turner and Holder in Sydney, at which he offered them places in his ministry, and reports they held firm and they refused to serve. But he does not seem to be aware they were initially inclined to accept. And this is what Barton told Downer. And I quote, in Sydney, Turner and Holder came over. If I remember, it was at Lyne's request. They came to see me at my home, me and Dutta, and told me he had offered them office. They asked what I would do. I rather think they wanted me to take office under Lyne anyhow. If I had done so, they would have followed suit. I told them that I'd refused in writing and by word to serve under any opponent of federation. And when I told them that nothing would induce me to alter my resolve, they too refused to join Lyne. The chain, if there was one, did hold, but it was never in Holder's power to break it. Had I not stood my ground, the chain must have broken, if there was one. Lyne, as we know, was forced to return his commission and recommend that Barton be asked to form the first government. Despite their close association, Downer was realistic about the limitations on Barton's ability to offer him a ministerial place. Apart from the PM, there were 8 posts to be allocated. It was generally understood that each colony would be represented. And in practice, this meant a ministry would comprise 2 from New South Wales, 2 from Victoria, and 1 from each of the small states. Places would be offered to those premiers or leaders who were making the transition to the federal parliament, which of course hadn't been elected at this stage. In South Australia's case, Holder, the premier, and Kingston, the previous Premier and Convention President and Delegate to London, were both available. And as a small state, South Australia could claim only 1 position. Barton commented on his choice in the letter to Downer cited above. The fact about Kingston, who joined Barton's cabinet, was that I offered him his choice between ministerial office and, so far as I could influence the matter, the speakership, intending to offer Holder office if Kingston refused it, and to do my best to get my friends to vote for Holder for the speakership if Kingston preferred office. Personally, I hoped Kingston's answer would enable me to ask Holder to be my colleague, but it was the other way. That's a very revealing comment, given that the volatile Kingston had in fact been the most adamant and strong supporter of Barton to become PM. And also interesting, in the light of Kingston's resignation from the ministry in 1903, the first of a number of events that caused Barton to relinquish office. Well, the election of the first parliament was set for 30th of March 1901. In South Australia, both the Senate and the House of Representatives were to be elected on a whole of state or single constituency basis. And Downer opted to stand for the Senate rather than the House of Representatives. Not surprisingly, given his advocacy of its role and fundamental importance. He saw it as the guarantor of true federalism, a body he'd done much to bring into existence and clothe with appropriate powers. And when nominations closed, there were 11 candidates for the 6 Senate places, a strong field. 10 of them were sitting members of the South Australian Parliament, 6 in the Legislative Council, including its president, and 4 in the Assembly. The exception was Josiah Simon, who'd not sat in Parliament since a defeat in the 87 elections, but had been an influential delegate to the convention. 7 of them had held ministerial office, 2 as Premier, 4 had been delegates to Australian constitutional conventions. The various combinations among the South Australian Senate candidates were intriguing and reflected what was happening in other states as well. A simple colonial party or factional alignment was not really possible. The election was broadly fought between free traders, who could be expected to support George Reed and his allies, and protectionists, comprising not only some of the Conservatives and Liberals, but also Labor candidates, who would support the incumbent Barton ministry. There were 5 declared free traders and 6 protectionists on the ballot. Downer, with protectionist leanings, was one reason he would support the ministry, but an overriding factor would be his personal affinity with Barton. Each elector could vote for up to 6 candidates, and the free traders had only 5 choices, so Downer could be seen as an acceptable non-doctrinaire choice among the others. Based on his colonial parliamentary reputation, his contribution to federation, Downer had a considerable advantage. On this first occasion, the term of the first 3 elected would go to the end of 1906, and the second 3 to the end of 1903, and Downer was very confident of getting a longer term. Well, the campaign was short and intense. The Senate result was an even division between the supporters of free trade and protection. The protectionists gained 52% of the vote, and 3 seats divided between non-Labor with 2 seats and Labor with 1. The free traders, 48% of the vote and 3 seats. This wasn't a great surprise, although the free traders had done better than expected. What was a surprise was the order of the election. The poll was topped by Simon, the non-parliamentarian, although a leading lawyer with a reputation as an active federalist who'd chaired the Judiciary Committee of the convention. Second elected was Thomas Playford, former Premier and Agent General and mentor of Charles Kingston. Richard Baker, the Conservative President of the Legislative Council and Chairman of Committees of the Convention, was next elected, and then followed Downer, ahead of a dissident Labor free trader Charleston and United Labor Party's McGregor. Simon's success was largely attributable to Kingston, who decided that his old foe, and Simon and Kingston had indulged in the most extraordinary political fights and personal fights over the years, among other things, Kingston had at one stage called Simon a forensic compound of squid and skunk, uttering his black ink over everything. There were others almost as bad, and they traded blows and insults. But Simon was vigorously opposed to amendments to the Constitution sought by the UK government to make the High Court secondary to the Privy Council. Downer, incidentally, had also supported Kingston in this matter. But for Kingston, Simon was rather like a prodigal son who'd returned to the fold. In fact, as a member of Barton's cabinet, Kingston should have owed some loyalty to those like Downer who supported the ministry. But the fact that Simon supported George Reed's free trade was overtaken by Kingston's feeling of gratitude to his newly found ally. He'd even managed to secure an endorsement of Simon from a very sceptical Labor Party, and advocated his election. Downer was understandably annoyed and disappointed by the result. He wrote bitterly to both Barton and to Alfred Deakin, who was Barton's Attorney General then. His letter to Barton is not preserved, but this is what he told Deakin. "I'm glad to hear from Barton that you have a good working majority. That your ministry has the support and influence of myself and my friends is in no way due to any action of your government. On the contrary, your colleague, Mr. Kingston, has succeeded by his intrigues against your principal supporter here, myself, in placing that support low on the list instead of being on top, and in electing the principal opponent of your policy here to the leading position. For Downer, the disappointment was confounded by the fact that his old enemy, Thomas Playford, had also come in ahead of him, and that in coming fourth, he'd been relegated to the short term, expiring in 1903. Well, Frederick Holder, incidentally, the speaker. You can see a man who doesn't look extraordinarily fit, but a great servant of Australian politics. And this is Sir John Downer in his new role as a senator, the familiar cigar still placed in his mouth. What were his expectations on entering the Senate? It was his house of first choice. His concern throughout the constitution-making process was to ensure the Senate had the power and authority to play its role in protecting the states from federal domination. A state needed to be able to look to its senators to safeguard its rights and authorities. He'd actually proposed it be called the States Assembly, but this had been unsuccessful. But there was no question in his mind that that's what it was and what the majority of delegates to the convention believed they'd created. And there were at least three assurances that this would be its role. First was a claim that it could be a house of democratic representation. The advocates of popular democracy had asked how an upper house, whose members were drawn in equal numbers from the state without regard to population discrepancies, could claim authority against a popularly elected lower house. 90 years later, this argument was most colourfully expressed by a former Prime Minister as the Senate being comprised of unrepresentative swill. Now, in response to it being seen as unrepresentative, Downer had always been careful to distinguish the Senate from the upper houses of the colonies, the legislative councillors, protecting particular landed interests, some appointed, as in New South Wales, some elected under very limited franchise. He'd also rejected the concept of state parliaments nominating, for instance, under the German constitution, they did and do to this day, the representatives in the upper house. He was a supporter of that democratic election. And that gave the Senate, he felt, a special authority, elected directly by the people of the state under the same voting qualifications as applied to the House. Arguably, a statewide election, proportional representation, have made it even more so in the present. It's, after all, been the only chamber in recent times to consistently provide an opportunity for minor parties and independents to be represented. Now, secondly, Downer believed the quality of its members would ensure the equality of the Senate with the House of Representatives, as expressed in the Constitution, and that would be sustained as intended. He saw no analogy with the British House of Lords, no desire to preserve or create a form of aristocracy, but he hoped that the Senate would attract senior statesmen with authority and status similar to US counterparts. He acknowledged the Senate in Australia didn't have the same sweeping powers as the US Senate, but he believed it would at least match the House in authority and be seen as a place in which the most able politicians of the state would aspire. Ideally, it should, at least initially, be comprised of men who'd been part of the making of the Constitution. As it happened, of the 36 members of the first Senate, only 9 of the former delegates were elected in 1901, although 4 of them were South Australians. Well, that didn't actually happen. It didn't last, in fact, because some of the key retirements from the first two Senates, including that of Downer himself, saw the quality of Senate representation begin to lower very early. The concept of swill, in unrepresentative swill, was in large part directed to the first 70 years or so of pre-selections by the major parties that have tended, with a few outstanding exceptions, to use the Senate for placemen and loyalists who might not succeed in a representative contest but could shelter or be rewarded under a Senate ballot. This has changed somewhat with the advent of the tighter and less predictable contests of contemporary times, but such candidates have not yet disappeared entirely from the party tickets. Thirdly, a few delegates had presciently suggested that party loyalty would prevail over state affiliation among senators. Downer was of the old school of factional government. He accepted candidates would have broad party affiliations, but he didn't believe they would or should override their responsibilities to the state. Liberals and Conservatives could find themselves in either the free trade or protectionist camps. Labor favoured protections. The first federal ministry was protectionist, but contained Conservatives such as Barton, radical Liberals such as Kingston. In that situation, Downer felt it would be impossible for party whips to enforce a discipline when state interests were at stake. The opposing view was put to the test quite early. It was quickly apparent that party rather than state lines would be the hallmark of Senate divisions. Now, at this point, the future national political career of Downer looked bright. His seniority and prominence of the federal movement gave him considerable authority. The Bulletin provides an interesting portrait of him this time. Perhaps they said, and they weren't a supporter of Downer, incidentally, much preferring the radical Kingston, perhaps the homeliest looking man in the federal legislature, whom nature built for a champion bruiser, but circumstances made him, like three other brothers, a lawyer, John Downer is an absolutely straight man of great grit. He never loses a personal friend. Though just on 60, Downer married a handsome and charming Sydney girl 2 years ago and is fully determined to live on until he is 100. So he was in the Senate to ensure the federal compact was realised as he'd envisaged it. And there were two further possible uses of his talent. Firstly, the ministry. Apart from the Senate, this was an important place for the small states. The cabinet not only ensured that there was representation from each of the states, but also there was Senate representation. Barton's cabinet contained three from New South Wales, two from Victoria, one from each of the colonies, and two of his ministers, Richard O'Connor, government leader of the Senate, and James Drake, were from Queensland. So there were two senators. Downer's claim to a cabinet post at that stage was referred to earlier, and obviously it wasn't possible. As the Review of Reviews put it, at that time, Downer does not represent, as between him and Kingston, Downer does not represent dominant opinion in the state, and politically he is, if not an extinct, at least a slumbering volcano. But two events in 1903 opened up the possibility of the volcano waking. The first was Kingston's resignation in July 1903. It provided an opportunity for another South Australian appointment. The second was O'Connor's appointment in September to the High Court, which created a senatorial ministerial vacancy. Barton had also resigned and departed, and Deakin had taken over as Prime Minister. It would have been a seamless and appropriate change for Downer to take the South Australian spot, as well as O'Connor's role in the Senate. Of the South Australians, Richard Baker was the presiding officer of the Senate and would not have been available. Simon was the leader of the opposition in the Senate, and as the cartoonist demonstrates here, he and his colleague from legal colleague from South Australia had been engaged in a lot of mudslinging as between themselves over legislation. But there was no way that the Deakin Barton government would appoint Simon. So that left some members of the lower house. Glynn and Solomon had both been in the conventions, but Downer stood out. However, the other candidate was Senator Playford. And despite Deakin and Downer having been associated in the federal movement since their voyage to the Imperial Conference in 1887 and later alliances, they'd clashed on a number of issues. And keen on stamping his government as a strongly liberal protectionist one, Deakin chose Playford, Kingston's ally, and Downer's long-term opponent. But the second and very possible one was appointment as a member of the High Court. It was not until 1903 that the Attorney General Deakin introduced a bill to create the High Court as provided by the Constitution. And as the Judiciary Bill made its progress through the process of Parliament, there was considerable speculation about who would be asked to serve on its inaugural bench. There's no secret, Downer's name was high on that list. He had outstanding qualifications for the post as a principal draftsman of the Constitution and one of the country's leading barristers. But more than that, he'd always been a great advocate for the court's prime place in the Constitution. He'd seen it as a fundamental part of the Federation. He saw it as the only guarantee that the Constitution could not be arbitrarily flouted by any government, however popular. Typical of his feeling on this issue was an interjection in the course of the consideration of the Constitution in the South Australian Assembly. I think he said, "The Supreme Court is the one protection of the Constitution. When the value of its establishment was questioned," he interjected, "it is to prevent the evasion of the Constitution." He rejected it was a way for lawyers to make money. He pointed out that this was analogous to the US Supreme Court in its constitutional role. "It is not," he said, "a paltry question of lawyers and lawyers' fees." So he'd been a great advocate of the independence of the bench, of the need to ensure that it took its place as one of the three great branches of governance under the federal system. He insisted that, for instance, judges should be protected from removal by arbitrary or other ways. Kingston and others favoured a system where a motion of both houses could be brought into play. Downer said it should be done by a trial conducted in the most solemn circumstance, not by way of political debate, where the judge might be accused on account of all sorts of causes and prejudice apart from its merits. The best method, he felt, was a kind of impeachment process conducted between the two houses. He was not able to get support for that, and the system remains a motion of both houses of Parliament at present. The other one was on appeals to the Privy Council, and I've already mentioned his strong opposition to providing for continuing appeals. He felt the court should be the final arbiter within Australian law, a good passage in debate in the convention between himself, Simon Fraser from Victoria, the grandfather of Malcolm Fraser, and Sir Edward Braddon of Tasmania. Downer, I'd like to ask, he said, they were suggesting it was very good that we could go to the Privy Council, when do we get out of our swaddling clothes? What are we here for? Mr. Fraser, not to cut the painter with Britain. Sir Edward Braddon, not to deprive the British subject of a right. Downer, we've come to the conclusion we must cease to be provincial and form the foundation of a nation. While remaining loyal to the Crown, we think we can make laws which will suffice us. In other words, to put it colloquially, we can manage our own affairs. Well, Downer spoke eloquently in the debate on the establishing the court, which came about through a bill introduced in 1903. It took some time for the government to actually get to the point of establishing the High Court. And the debate ebbed and flowed. The Judiciary Bill reflected many of Downer's views, but there was this argument that there was not sufficient work for the court. It would be too expensive in servicing and judges' salaries, and a better alternative might be to appoint state judges to act in a joint capacity. They were overcome, but the compromise was to reduce the number of judges to be appointed from the five contemplated to three. Well, where did that leave the decision? The fact is that five jurisdictions could provide five judges, perhaps balanced around the colonies. Western Australia could probably be excluded from consideration at this time. It had only just ceased to be a Crown colony. Its judiciary is not as well established. So you could make a neat federal court to begin with. The leading candidates would include those in judicial office in the states, as well as those who'd been involved in the drafting of the Constitution and were in most cases members in their own right. There were two early convention delegates with great influence. The first, Sir Samuel Griffith of Queensland. He hadn't been in the 1897 convention, but he certainly made his mark in 1891, drafting that first constitution. On the other hand, he had supported reserving the right of appeal to the British Council, which some objected to. And the second was Andrew Inglis Clark of Tasmania, who'd done an early and influential draft of the Constitution, been prominent in the debates, but again had been absent in 1897-8 and critical of that convention's work. Now, to this you could add Barton himself, but he was the Prime Minister, O'Connor, some State Attorney Generals, Higgins and Isaacs from Victoria, Downer, Simon from South Australia. The press called for a balanced bench. A protectionist government obviously would not appoint Simon, so the appointments would be, logically, O'Connor from New South Wales, Isaacs from Victoria, Griffith, Queensland, South Australian Downer and Tasmania, Inglis Clark. Barton, as could be expected, was a very strong supporter of the claims of Downer and O'Connor. Both men had high expectations they'd be appointed. Well, the attack on the costs of the judiciary resulted in the reduction of the number of judges. Resist as they may, Downer and others, it was carried. Now, the reduction need not have been fatal to Downer's chances. A bench comprising O'Connor, Griffith and Downer would have suited the temperament and geographical spread of the government. But the Prime Minister, facing political difficulties, wanting a quieter life, reserved a place for himself. While still persisting with O'Connor, although this meant there'd be two from New South Wales, and the third place went to Griffith ahead of Downer. Incidentally, O'Connor was the only senator to serve on the High Court until Lionel Murphy was appointed 72 years later. There'd been something like 13 justices with previous parliamentary experience. The decision was a devastating one for Downer. Particularly, he'd been let down by his close friend and ally who'd given him every encouragement on the matter. The Chief Justice of South Australia, Sir Samuel Way, who knew Downer well, wrote to an acquaintance 2 days after the announcement that poor Sir John is very disappointed. There's no doubt that Barton had committed himself to him. And a month later, he corresponded with the former Governor of South Australia, Lord Tennyson, now acting as Governor General of the Commonwealth. Downer, I think, is now getting over his disappointment, but could hardly expect to be one of three. When Barton committed himself to him, it was expected five judges would be appointed. Now, I've uncovered in the course of my research that there may have been another factor working against Downer, which was hinted at in earlier correspondence by Way. By this stage, Downer was finding life uncomfortable, frustrated with a Senate that was increasingly operating on party lines against his loftier expectations. He was unhappy spending much futile time in Melbourne at the sittings, away from his family, his home and his legal practice. His young wife accompanying him to Melbourne on occasions, but it was not much of a life for her. They even had a bad carriage accident on one occasion when in Melbourne. It seems it was the only time in his life that he'd suffered bouts of depression. Way had heard that he was spending too much time in the parliamentary bar. In contrast to his friend Barton, who'd been renowned for enjoying the good life to excess, but was now very disciplined. Sir John Downer, says Way in a letter, has Barton's very strong support, but he is constantly, and here the word is inked out, it's indecipherable, but I interpret it as drunk, because it goes on to say, Sir John Downer has Barton's very strong support, but he's constantly drunk, so it is questionable if any government would dare to appoint him. At this stage, Way felt that if Downer was not appointed, it would be, quote, through his own folly in not having become a total abstainer soon enough. Benython, also writing to someone in London, commented enigmatically but significantly on the preference of Playford for the ministry that we guess here, and I'm afraid you'll be able to guess too why Downer was passed over. I'm sorry for him, but he has himself to blame. And on the High Court decision, he commented, John Downer is terribly disgusted, although for a reason you may guess, he's not been for a very long time even in the running. It's worth remembering that both Way and Benython were teetotalers and somewhat censorious of those who weren't, but clearly at this stage there was a problem. He may have been putting a good face on it, but relations between Downer and Barton now became very strained. It took years for them to repair their friendship. The High Court went on its first circuit to Adelaide in November 1903. Way was in charge of the welcome, and during the visit, Griffith stayed at Government House as Chief Justice. O'Connor stayed with Sir Samuel at his mansion in Montefiore, but significantly, for the first time ever in many visits to Adelaide over more than a decade, Barton didn't stay with Sir John at his Pennington Terrace house, but in fact lodged with Griffith at Government House. Way hosted a banquet for the court at the Adelaide Club, but he noted Sir John wouldn't come. Well, 3 years later, the bench was expanded by two, and there was another possibility that Downer could well have been appointed. There was a strong claim for a South Australian appointee, but he didn't have the patronage of Barton and his uneasy relationship with Deakin. He wasn't aware of Deakin's unpublished negative view that he, Downer, was reserved and indolent. In Cabinet, Downer would have had the support of Sir John Forrest, but would have been more than matched by the opposition of William Lyon and the veto of his oldest political opponent, Thomas Playford. He was again at the rear of the queue. Chief Justice Way was offered the place, but refused, seeing it as a demotion from his joint appointment as Chief Justice of South Australia and a Privy Councillor. He felt it was a bit demeaning. Way's refusal resulted in the appointment of a second Victorian, the radical Henry Higgins. Sir John's claims lapsed at that point forever. And, incidentally, there's never been a South Australian appointee to the High Court to this day. Well, to conclude, there'd been other disappointments in Downer's life, including the bleak years of opposition in the 1890s, being denied an opportunity to serve in a federal cabinet. But it was certainly true that not being appointed to the High Court of Australia was his greatest. Nearing the end of the first term, the Senate was showing signs of very partisan behaviour, failing to live up to the standards of independence from the executive and representatives he'd expected. He announced he'd not be standing for a second term in the election, but would return to full-time legal practice in South Australia. His federal disillusion was underlined a year later when he became a South Australian elder statesman, entering the Legislative Council in which he served until his death in 1915. In retrospect, it's easy to see why Downer became disillusioned. His concept of federalism was based on a system of factional organisation which did not properly account for the rise of the parties. It was no longer possible. The Senate was not able to live up to his expectations of a United States model, as Australian Federation was grafted onto the Westminster system. His hopes of office of the bench were not fulfilled. Politics generally wearied him. To bow out of the federal scene almost exactly 20 years after he'd made his first major contribution and where he'd been so important was the right thing to do, and he lived on to enjoy an Indian summer. And there indeed is Sir John in 1910, unexpectedly blessed with a son of his second marriage. That son is Sir Alec Downer, became Sir Alec Downer, Minister of Immigration in the Menzies government, Australian High Commissioner to London, and is the father, in turn, of Alexander Downer, former Foreign Minister of Australia. That's the three generations of Downers, and Sir John gratified, although he died about 5 years after this, gratified with the son and the heritage. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. The book, Supreme Federalist, we've got some order forms if anyone's interested in getting the book. There's an offer of free postage to anywhere in Australia. They'll be held up there, but I'm delighted to have had the opportunity to talk to you about it. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that fascinating account of the life of Sir John Downer. We've got time for a couple of questions. Anyone who'd like to ask a question, can you make your way to the microphone at the side? But while people do that, I might just ask it. There was such a surfeit of talent in politics in 1901, and particularly from South Australia. If you look at the members of the first senators from South Australia, you know, all stars in their own right. What was it about the colony of South Australia that promoted these people? What was it that allowed South Australia to come up with all these innovations in electoral matters?
Well, I think it's obviously part of the political culture, but the thing that really distinguished South Australia was the way in which there was this general consensus about federation being the way to go, that what had happened in the settlement of Australia was sort of incomplete. And this moved across all party lines. Some of the Labor Party people were a bit sceptical. Thomas Price, who became Premier of South Australia, was one of those, although interestingly he put his hand up to be a federal representative, having denounced the federation, a bit like William Lyon. You know, there was a big attraction there. But there was this broad consensus, and I think part of it was a very strong national concept, because the South Australia's origins as a convict-free colony and so on was something that, whether it made much difference in reality, its tradition of radical, sometimes utopian politics, saw this as a high ideal. But secondly, it was very pragmatic too. South Australia was concerned that it was going to be caught outside the major economic developments and other things that would happen, that Australia would fracture, WA would go its own way, and the eastern coast, leaving South Australia isolated, whereas in fact federation could make it the hub, the transport hub, the railway connector, the communications and various other links which could make it a significant player. So it was partly the concept of how the colony could thrive if it was part of a national body that drove them to it. And the best and brightest worked at this assiduously, which is why Alfred Deakin conceded they were the ablest delegation of the convention, and others commented on their imprint, which is on just about every section of the Constitution.
Mm. And, of course, it even goes down as far as Humble Clarks, the first clerk of the Senate, being the former Clerk of the Assembly in South Australia.
Interesting that that Blackmore, who was appointed Clerk in the 1897 convention because it was being held in Adelaide, and did such a brilliant job that he remained in place for the sessions in both Sydney and Melbourne, held in those Parliament houses, as did the President. And Richard Baker was his Chairman of Committees, so he and Blackmore worked very close together. By smooth transition, Baker became the first President and Blackmore the first Clerk. And in fact, to the extent the Senate has some elements of independence in its procedures and standing orders, relates to that combination of South Australian gentlemen who strongly felt they were asked virtually to reproduce standing orders and rules of procedure that would mirror the House of Representatives. So there would be no real difference, and the two would be indistinguishable in that sense. Baker and Blackmore both insisted on the special nature of the Senate and recognised its composition, and that's certainly remained in force today. Mm-hmm. Your predecessor is a very strong advocate of that, and I'm sure you are too.
Absolutely. Well, are there any questions? If not, you've satisfied the audience 100%, John, so please join me in thanking the Honourable Dr. John Bannon for a very interesting lecture. And we'll see you all again soon.